Natalia Sylvester, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Let's see. We were trying to figure out when the last time you were on the show, on our show, and I think it was for your, well, it was for your first novel, Chasing the Sun, and that was probably a few years ago, right?
Yeah, it came out in 2014. It's been 4 or 5 years.
Gosh, yeah, that's right. Well, let's see. It would have been 2015 because that was the first time I was on the air with Words on a Wire. So yeah, we got it. Okay, good. Oh. So you're a second timer on our show, and we're really glad to have you back with your brand new book, Everyone Knows You Go Home, which is a fantastic book, by the way. It recently came out. Well, it came out last year with Little A Press.
Yeah.
And I want to jump into that. It's kind of an unusual story. I'll call it an unusual story for lack of a better adjective right now. But it's an unusual kind of a story which navigates a family's past and how the repercussions of the past, you can say, decisions made, grief, sacrifices, all of that sort of plays out in the present. And I'm going to hold off on saying any more and because I would like for our listeners to get a sample of that. So would you mind reading us an excerpt from Everyone
Knows? Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, and thank you for that introduction. I like unusual stories, so.
Yeah, there are many other adjectives I will come up with along the way, but that's one. I'll start there.
So this is actually just the first few pages of the book.
Okay,
chapter one.
I'll follow along. Okay.
They were married on the Day of the Dead, El Día de los Muertos, which no one gave much thought to in all the months of planning until the bride's deceased father-in-law showed up in the car following the ceremony. He manifested behind the wheel, then stretched his arm over the back of the passenger seat as he turned to face Martin and Isabel. Beautiful ceremony, mijo, he said. The couple's smiles froze. It seemed to take an eternity for either of them to speak, and when they did, they had little more than mumbles. Her whole life, Isabel had heard stories about spirits who spent this one day of the year with family. As a child, she had built altars for her great-grandparents, vibrant tributes made out of open shoeboxes adorned with paper flowers and pictures of religious figures that looked a lot like the dioramas she created in grade school. In her teens, her family congregated around her great-aunt's grave to clean it. One year, her mother even brought a battery-operated vacuum for the stone. Today, we remember our dead, her mother always said. We honor them. Martin's father was more frazzled than dead, as if he was running late because he had been caught in traffic. Isabel looked to her new husband for guidance and was shocked to realize he seemed annoyed. Not afraid, because honestly, her father-in-law looked harmless, just like in the few pictures she had seen of him. No, Martin looked like he had simply bitten into a pepper that was hotter than anticipated. Did you know this would happen, she said. No, but it's typical of him. Typical. Only someone so shameless would show up to a wedding uninvited. Martin, please. She hadn't expected him to be so rude. She hadn't expected any of this at all, but her instincts to remain polite and respect her elders were deeply ingrained, even more than her assumptions about life and death, apparently. And so her efforts to understand the situation were quickly overridden by her desire to make everybody feel comfortable. It was the first time she had met her father-in-law. She smoothed her white dress, which was bulging into every inch of his feet, and straightened her veil over her shoulders. Aren't you going to introduce us? The old man sat quietly, waiting. I'm not talking to him, Martin said. Martin, you can't be serious. At this, her father-in-law smiled and leaned toward her through the small space that separated the front and back of the white Rolls Royce they had rented. He is, I promise you. That kind of stubbornness runs deep in our blood. Isabel, I'm Omar, so I hope they've at least told you my name. Of course, she said. Encantada. I'll just stop there for now.
Wonderful. And if you are just tuning into Words on a Wire, that is the voice of Austin-based novelist Natalia Sylvester reading from her latest novel, Everyone Knows You Go Home, which we are focusing on today. But I'd like to talk with Natalia also about all of your wonderful things that you've got going on. I know you're also a sort of a freelance writer as well. Not sort of. You actually are a freelance writer. You came out with some wonderful articles most recently in the New York Times as well. I want to talk with you about some of that too. Thank you for reading that excerpt. You know, one of the first things that strikes me and I'm glad you opened up with that, actually, that beginning part of the story, is really the kind of almost like a non-issue of which Omar arrives in the backseat of the vehicle. Like it's a non-issue, right? It's his spirit that has arrived, or the ghost of him, and he basically, you know, and his son and his new daughter-in-law like aren't making an issue of it. It doesn't matter how he arrived or the fact that he's there as a sort of this ghostly figure, but that's not even what Martin, his son, is concerned with so much as like he's uninvited, you know?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what went into that kind of a decision to make his presence really a non-spectacle. Mm-hmm. In fact, he's really kind of a non-spectacle throughout the entire book. No one really looks at the fact that, you know, he's existing in that realm.
Yeah, and actually that was really important to me, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I think this two-part, you know, it came about in two ways, and I think one of them is probably, you know, that a lot of it is often compared to magical realism, and right. I don't consider it that, but I can see why maybe, like, you know, growing up and even now, I have always enjoyed reading magical realism, but sure. I do think that there's a very clear definition of, like, you know, when you look at traditional magical realism, it's like the so-called magical element, excuse me, is made to be so bizarre and fantastical so as to mimic the bizarre and weirdness and, you know, extraordinariness of life.
Right.
And for me, I think, like, I've always enjoyed how matter-of-factly that is integrated into stories, but I also didn't consider this book necessarily an act of magic an example of that,
right.
Maybe partially influenced by that, but definitely not an example of that, because for me, what became important is that this isn't, like, the idea that your ancestors are with you and that they're here, like, this is actually part of a very long cultural tradition, and it's something that feels very natural to so many of us,
right.
That it doesn't feel fantastical, and so to have it became, I think that for many of us who have lived in the U.S. and, you know, have felt deeply rooted to our own cultures, but not always necessarily feeling like that is something that we are that maybe everyone around us understands.
Right.
We've often felt the need to have to explain our culture to others. And I don't particularly enjoy that. Like, I grew up, you know, often having, you know, feeling like what was everyday and very much a part of my everyday life and my family's life and people around me, like my culture, that there were those who saw it as like exotic and foreign and really wanted to kind of have it explained to them.
Right.
And I just didn't want to do that for this
right.
book, because I think that, that for those who do understand it and who have experienced it, what would be more, the most natural thing is to just, you know, have them feel at home, like have readers feel at home in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And then those who maybe, are not as familiar with it, then that they learn to navigate that on their own, you know, that they don't
right.
need to have it spoon fed. I think that we, that maybe we sometimes underestimate how much a reader can actually comprehend. And right. when I say we, I actually feel like really like the publishing industry as a whole, sometimes when they assume a reader, you know, that to them feels niche, meaning like, you know, they might think that, you know, a Latinx audience is niche, and then that we have to like then explain to what they call a mainstream audience, which feels like sometimes a coded word for like, you know, white audiences.
Right. Gotcha.
And I just think like, you know, nobody really benefits from that. You know, I feel like it hurts us by making us feel like we have to explain our culture to a white gaze. And then it also hurts those who are part of that audience by not challenging them to, you know, to learn about things outside of themselves without having it explained to them.
Right, right. Rather than being relegated to otherness, to that idea of otherness. You know, that was one of the, I think, sort of the early concerns that I think used to kind of plague me when I was when I was a hopeful writer once upon a time, was this idea of, you know, what section of the bookstore, that's back when we used to have bookstores, but I'm just kidding. There are some many great bookstores out there today. I'm just making a joke there, back when I would think, you know, do I want my book to be shelved in the Latino section, or should it be shelved right next to Hemingway and, you know, Steinbeck, and, you know, where does that book fit? Because obviously we're relegated often, you know, as Latino or Latinx, whatever you want to refer to them as, writers, to the barrio section of the library, or to the bookstore, you know. And, you know, I'm wondering too, Yet what we're writing, the stories, the narratives that you wrote here, that you write, that I write, that many of us write, they are American stories. You know, they are very much a part of that fabric. How do you feel about that? Just out of curiosity.
In terms of
where your books are shelved, where, you know, the way that you are marketed, which is another way of saying the way that you are marketed.
Yeah. You know, I agree with you. I think that I do feel like it's changing. I think I got lucky with my publisher that they really wanted to, you know, market this as a story about, like, and also importantly, and also equally importantly, without erasing the fact that it is about, you know, a Latinx family. And but they also wanted to market it as a story that wasn't only about, like, migration and crossing borders, but it was really about the ways that the things that families do for one another, the ways we keep secrets out of love and protection, the ways those secrets, affect each other across generations and across borders. And I think that it's a tricky question because I never want to pretend to be something I'm not. And I'm very proud of my heritage. I was born in Peru and I came to the U.S. when I was four.
Right.
And that's just always been very deeply a part of me. I think that part of, you know, when I was younger, I think I felt like this, almost like there was an erasure of who I was in the media all around me.
Yeah.
And so now that when I realized, you know, as I got older, how intentional that was, as a way to, like, make us feel like we had to assimilate in order to belong. I think I ended up kind of maybe the more rebellious part of myself that now wants to intentionally not reject it and intentionally embrace it as a way to say, no, I don't want any of this to be erased in order to be accepted, because if there are parts of us that are being erased, then that's not true acceptance. And not only that, but, like, even just, I don't want to center my sense of identity around this idea of outside acceptance. Like, how about, you know, the bonds that we create amongst each other and the pride and the strength that we can create amongst each other to empower one ourselves to, like, unapologetically be who we are. And so I don't know if that answers the question very well, but.
No, it does.
You
know, and it's interesting that you, you just said something I didn't expect, which is that you don't consider the book Magic real. Obviously, as I was reading it, and I can see why, but as I was reading it, I couldn't help but immediately, right out the gate, in the first page, immediately, you know, obviously call to mind, you know, some of the more magic real or books that are considered magic real that I have, you know, loved and cherished over time. Juan Rulfo's Pedro Páramo, or even Laura Esquivel or Isabel Allende's book, House of Spirits, you know, these kinds of books that had this magic real aspect. And I'm wondering, and so you answered the question, because what I wanted to ask you was, did you consider the book magic realism? But you just said that you don't, and for a very valid reason, obviously. But I'm curious to know, you know, are there, this is actually just a very personal curiosity, are there books by North American writers, or I should say writers living in, you know, who are from the United States today that are not, that don't have a Latino, Latinx background, but that are writing in this area of what we may call or suggest is magic realism? Are there books that do that here that you can think of? Sorry to put you on the spot for that.
I don't know. I'm probably not the best person to answer that question.
Okay.
What I have noticed is that there seems to be an ease with which people jump to magical realism, as a category, as soon as there's, like, some sort of magical element that is treated in a nonchalant way.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, another way to ask that question is, you know, is magic realism, and I mean, I'm asking this in a really naive way, obviously, but is magic realism, you know, something that Latinos have the corner on, you know, that we, you know, and I'm saying that obviously because by and large, that's usually what it's associated with is writers who are coming from a Latin American background or from Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always kind of on my own tried to seek out, well, who are the writers that are not from that background that are doing elements of that? And I'm sure they're out there. I just can't think of any at the moment, but.
I can't think of too many at the moment, although I've seen, Like, I have seen some writers from the South having used that label or similar. And I just, it's, in a strange way, I think that when I have, like, I remember one time I was at a conference when they had a panel all on magical realism, and they didn't have a single Latinx author on there.
Oh, wow.
And that bothered me because I was just like, well, you know, you have to, like, if you're going to, you know, write in a category, understand its history, understand where it came from, and don't erase that, you know?
Right, absolutely.
Because I also think it is far more complex than just having a, you know, a magical element that's treated matter-of-factly. Like, you know, when you look at its roots, it's very much used as, like, a way to make a statement on, like, the political and social realities that a lot of these authors were living in at the time.
Right.
During very tumultuous times in their own histories. And so it serves, like, it serves a far deeper purpose than just saying, oh, how fun is it that when we use magic and it's treated as an everyday thing? You know?
No, absolutely. I'm all on board with that. That's right. Yeah. And in fact, I mean, even just as a father raising his own children, you know, I find myself often talking about, you know, the spirits around us or the ghosts or, you know, I'd rather call them spirits myself, but, you know, the idea of our ancestors sort of among us in a very active way. And my children don't bat an eye at that. It's not like I'm telling them a ghost story. You know, they just kind of go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, of course. You know, and so for you to tell this story with Omar in a very matter of fact way without flinching, you know, it makes sense to me. I'm like, yeah, of course, Omar's in the backseat on his son's wedding day. You know, so I have another question. A while back, I mean, years ago, that's how you know you're getting older when you say a while back and you meant like, you know, 20 years ago. I read an interview where Gabriel Garcia Marquez had written that he got his idea for his book, Living to Tell the Tale, Vivir para Contarla. He got the idea from seeing a photo. I don't know if this is true or not, but this is what I read, that he had gotten the idea from seeing a photo of a little boy with an umbrella. And that's what prompted his whole idea for that book, to write that. And so I'm always intrigued at how authors get their initial idea for a story. So what prompted you, what prompted this idea for you?
Oh, gosh, it was very literal, actually. My husband and I were married on Dia de los Muertos.
That's great.
And it was, you know, like Martin and Isabel, it wasn't something that really occurred to us in the moment.
Yeah.
It's just sometimes you're planning a wedding and you go to a venue and they tell you these are the dates we have. And so, but over the years, we would, you know, people would randomly, I don't know, sometimes, you know, it comes up in conversation and people are like, oh, you're celebrating your anniversary. And they'd be like, oh, how funny, it's Dia de los Muertos. And I thought, oh, wow, yeah, that's interesting. But what became far more interesting to me, and I knew this, like the day I wrote the first page, I knew like three things. And I just knew that it would be, you know, Omar visiting Martin and Isabel, but that he would essentially be turned away by his loved ones. And so I was really more interested not in the how or, you know, like the mechanics of that, but I was really interested in what would make a family member who is, you know, who is dead be turned away by his loved ones. And so that really kind of became the whole impetus of the story for me. And the more I realized it and the more I wrote it and the more I wrote their histories, I realized that it kind of mirrored a lot of you know, a lot of what happens with our own, you know, because, you know, Omar has crossed like this spiritual border, but there are characters in the novel who cross like actual physical borders. And to me, the fact that he takes this incredibly long and treacherous journey that we don't even know what goes into that journey for him, only to be turned away by those he hoped would embrace him. It felt very parallel to the reality that a lot of immigrants face today. And in all the very ways that journey, you know, is taken, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's like the characters in the novel who cross from Mexico into Texas, or whether it's, you know, immigrants from any other parts of the world that fly into the U.S. and then, you know, struggle to find a sense of home.
Right. And if you are just tuning in to Words on a Wire, we are speaking with the wonderful, talented novelist Natalia Silvester about her new book, Everyone Knows You Go Home, and that is out with Little A Press. And so, yes, Natalia, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you as well is, you know, this character, the central character of Omar, who is essentially, again, if you're just tuning in, I'll remind you, he's really just a sort of a spirit. He's in the spirit world. He's in the afterlife, and he returns every day of the dead, and he shares his he shares these anecdotes or these stories or these sort of he shares his own backstory with Isabel, who is his daughter-in-law, his new daughter-in-law, and the stories include, like, you know, why he left Mexico or what's sort of been plaguing his spirit for a long time. And what I wanted to ask you about really was this idea of returning or a revisiting, you know, where you could have, as an author, made the choice to have Omar present from the beginning all the way through the end, but you have him actually sort of returning and revisiting. There's more I want to say about that, but I think I'm just going to ask you, what about this returning or revisit compels you to write about this idea of coming back?
Yeah, I think mainly it was because I was very intrigued by this idea of what happens in between things, in between spaces that that we live in. And so, you know, part of what is that even I don't know is like what happens to him in between these two moments, like every year, when he returns. But then it also became important for me to understand, well, then what is happening in the life of these characters in the in-between moments between when, you know, every day of the dead. And so I think part of it too was that him being a spirit initially presented a real challenge for me because there's only so much power he has he can only really essentially talk, right? Mm-hmm. And speak to whoever will hear him.
Right.
And so that turns out to be Isabel. But I had to kind of like go back and deconstruct all the things I learned about creative writing, which is like, I remember when I was in school and even in workshops, we often hear this idea of, you know, your protagonist has to be this proactive person, you know, entity, like driving the story forward.
Right.
And again, he didn't have a lot of power traditionally by what, like by the way we perceive that power to be in terms of driving his own story forward.
And, you know, speaking about how you went about constructing the decisions you made and constructing this narrative, you know, the story leaps back and forth in time and geography. And it does so seamlessly, actually. You know, I really like the way that it was just, I was easy to sort of maneuver that without disruption or without trying to figure it out. You know, it was just allowed me to stay in the story. And I'm wondering, though, you know, as somebody who's attempted to write that kind of seamless back and forth, I know that it's really difficult to do. And I'm wondering what your writing process was like in putting that together.
Thank you. Yeah, it was very difficult. So it makes me happy to feel like to hear that you thought it was seamless.
Yeah. I was like, how did you do that? I got to learn that.
Yeah, no, it's funny because I actually originally in the early drafts, I started out, you know, that first scene that I read is really the first thing I wrote. Uh-huh. And then I just thought I would write the whole book in the structure I wanted it to be in. So I would, you know, I wrote the second chapter in the the next few chapters kind of going back and forth in time. So like this 1981 storyline and then more like present day.
Right.
And what I realized is by doing that, I was actually pulling myself out of the story every single time.
Right.
And so eventually I just ended up abandoning the present day story, going completely back to the past. And realizing also that in order for me to write the present story of this family, I needed to fully understand their roots and their past. And so I kind of allowed myself to really just immerse myself in that and write that all the way from beginning to end.
Wow.
And then I stepped back and wrote the present day from beginning to end. And in revision really was when the work of like braiding everything. I always call it braiding and I'm like,
right.
I'm very like visual about that. And I used, on a more technical level, I actually used Scrivener because Scrivener lets you like drag and drop entire scenes. You know, with like, having to cut and paste everything, which is a nightmare because I've tried that before.
Yeah, that's what I do. I do the nightmare route. That's the way I go, is the nightmare.
Yeah, no. No.
Yeah.
I highly recommend Scrivener because you can, you know, like every scene is its own little like label and you can just drag and drop it.
Yeah, and that's, even though they seem like small tools, they could be extremely helpful when trying to put together an entire narrative like this, you know?
Yeah.
I know how much, writing period is hard work, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick the – let me see. I'm going to pick two questions to ask you.
Okay.
Hopefully we can get those answered. One of them I wanted to ask is – let's see. Is that you – your background is from Peru. Your family's from Peru. That's where you were born also, I believe, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
And yet – so I want to know what went into your decision in rooting this story in a Mexican – in a family of Mexican descent in Texas, you know, which is a far cry from Peru, I would assume.
Yeah.
I would assume. But I just – yeah, what was into – what went into that decision?
Sure. So when I – my family moved – when we moved to the U.S., we moved first to Miami. Then we moved to Central Florida, and then we moved to McAllen. Actually, we lived in Mission, and my dad worked in McAllen. I was there, like, in the mid-90s for a few years, and then, you know, we moved away. We just moved around a lot. But there was something about my time in the Valley that just really always stayed with me. So that was one part of it. But the other part of it was that in my home, you know, we're very much connected to our Peruvian culture, but I feel like, and I think this is true for a lot of Latinx people, like our communities are incredibly diverse, right? And so, every time I write a story, I think about ways, like, for example, my first book was set in Peru and it was about a Peruvian family, based a little bit on my own family's experience, but I always think about, like, what can I, like, this needs to be about more than my experience. I feel like it needs to be bigger than that. So when I was drawn to a story set in the Valley, it felt it would be more truthful to the experience of in the Valley of having that be a family of Mexican-American immigrants, because at the time my family was there, we were really more the exception. And I didn't want to make this story about, solely that part of our experience. I wanted to make it about the experience, the ways that our experience overlaps. And so I feel like the emotional parts of our experience, I was trying to kind of channel that, like this idea of wanting to feel at home, struggling to do so. There were parts that I pulled from my own experience. There were parts where I just spoke with people and tried to, ask them about their own experiences and kind of just trying to create, these separate characters who could tell their own story without telling the story of either. Like, you know, anyone I spoke to, for example, like even if they shared their stories with me, I just felt like those are their stories. And it's really my job to listen and hopefully create a story that feels true and honors that. But it's truly just these characters' stories and not somebody else's.
Yeah, and you did a wonderful job of it. It's just a fantastic book. The book is titled Everyone Knows You Go Home. The author is Natalia Sylvester. And the book is out with Little A. You can probably get it anywhere that you look for, anywhere they sell books, I would imagine.
Yeah.
It's really great to have you back. And if you're interested, for the listeners out there, if you're interested in hearing more from Natalia, we also have archived on our website, Words on a Wire at KTEP. We have her first interview we did with her on her first book, Chasing the Sun, about back in 2015, around there. So you can listen to that as well. And Natalia, it's just been really great having you on our show again. Thank you for taking the time.
Absolutely.
Congratulations again. And hopefully
thank
this
you.
Book continues to do great for you.
Thank you so much, Tim. Uh-huh.